Hello, sports fans, and welcome to another edition of Yesterday Sports on the Sports History Network. And make sure to check out sportshistorynetwork.com/giveaways. I have two signed books I'm giving away. One is titled No Nonsense, Old School Weight Training, and the other is Reliving 1970s Old School Football.
We have a special treat today. We have our guest, Dr. John Behe, author of two books on Fielding H. Yost, the great coach, most famously of Michigan. He's going to tell Coach Yost's story from beginning to end in part one of this three-part series on Fielding H. Yost with Dr. John Behe, coming up in just a moment.
This is the Pigskin Daily History Dispatch, a podcast that covers the anniversaries of American football events throughout history on a day-to-day basis. Your host, Darren Hayes, is podcasting from America's North Shore to bring you the memories of the gridiron one day at a time. So as we come out of the tunnel of the Sports History Network, let's take the field and go no huddle through the portal of positive gridiron history with PigskinDispatch.com.
This podcast is part of the Sports History Network, your headquarters for the yesteryear of your favorite sport. You can learn more at SportsHistoryNetwork.com.
Hello, my football friends. This is Darren Hayes of PigskinDispatch.com. Welcome once again to the Pigpen, your portal of positive football history. And we're going to look down that portal today and go back some 130, 135 years to talk about one of the greatest coaching legends of all time, and that's Fielding H. Yost, most famously of Michigan. And to help us with this, we have a gentleman that has wrote two books over the last 50-some years, and that is Dr. John Behe of his great book, Coach Yost, Michigan's Tradition Maker. Right now, we'll welcome him in. Dr. John Behe, welcome to the Pigpen.
Thank you. Thank you much, Darren. Good to be with you.
Well, Doctor, you have such an interesting outlook on Fielding H. Yost and his entire career. I mean, you talk a lot about Michigan in the book, but you talk about him prior to Michigan as a player and as a coach at some other places as well. And we're gonna talk about that. But what gave you the passion of writing about Coach Yost in the first place?
That's a good question. I was a high school football coach for 4 years, and then I got a chance to work at a small college in Kansas, my home state. I met Bob Holloway, who was the defense coach at the University of Michigan, and he really helped me considerably in those early coaching years. So when I finished my bachelor's degree and then my master's degree, I thought, I want to do the doctorate, and I really want to do it somewhere around a good football program. And in 6 years, there was in my lap, Michigan. So I talked to Bob, and he said, yeah, well, you got to apply and get accepted, and if you get accepted, I'll put you to work. And that's what he did. I got accepted in the graduate program at the University of Michigan and showed up there in 1964, September, to begin the coursework. And Bump Elliott was the head coach, and he immediately he just embraced me. And I think because of his confidence in Bob Holloway, his defense coordinator. And I sat in on every coach's meeting that I could, you know, where I wasn't in class for 2 years, 64 and 65. January 1, 65 was a Rose Bowl championship year, as you may know. And so I was in seventh heaven learning about Michigan football from the people who were really experts, and also I started hunting then for a dissertation topic because I did not want to just do the coursework. There were a lot of ABDs, all but dissertations, out there, and I didn't want to be one of them. So I wind up with picking Yost as my topic, and finally, after a long track, in 1970, finished the course, not only the coursework, but finished the dissertation. And Fielding Yost's legacy to the University of Michigan came out of that. That was my dissertation.
Wow, that is pretty interesting. Now, I failed to mention earlier that your latest book came out just a year or two ago during COVID. It's called Coach Yost, Michigan's Tradition Maker by John Behe. And you can reach ways of purchasing that particular book at Behe, which is Behe.com, Behe.com. They have a few different stores there you can link to get your purchase on that book. Now, Doctor, going back to Coach Yost, he wasn't always a coach. According to your book, he was quite the player, too, wasn't he?
Well, first of all, a West Virginian. Comes out of a pretty good gene pool, some pretty bright people, but in a very, very modest living area in the western part of West Virginia, forgotten by most people, you know, not very arable soil, and they're going to make their living by what's, well, of course, the forest. They can do lumbering, but everything else is below the surface. And so anyway, those were mining, coal mining, salt mining, and those were tough jobs. He was when I look at the guy's character as I studied his football teams and his coaching techniques, he was fearless. And I look at his youth, and I'm thinking, that's where it came from. He, as a 10-year-old, this was his first experience with the school. He was in Fremont, in a small town in West Virginia, and Fairview, 10 miles away, they had a school. He walked that 10 miles with his brother after a while, but he walked to school and back. And the school was only offered in the dead of winter. So he's in Nowheresville, walking 10 miles each direction to school in the middle of winter, and he's excited about it because he gets to learn.
And West Virginia is not the flattest place in the world either, is it?
No, hills and dales and you know, rivers running off. But yeah, interesting. Yeah, interesting terrain. You're right. But now, and so, you know, he's in an environment where the people who are working are pretty rugged individuals. And, you know, they're miners. His dad has an outfitting shop and all the things that miners need to do the job, they come to his shop to purchase. Yost notices that, but his mom thinks that he'd be a good teacher, and he gets big. For a high school boy at 17, he was 6 foot, 195 pounds. And they made him a marshal because, you know, he gets some rowdiness, some drinking, and this sort of thing. So he's learning how to manage conflict as a 17-year-old. you know, he by 17, he is tough as nails. Now, his mom thinks he'll be a good teacher. So she says there's a nice Methodist school. She was a Methodist gal in Ohio called Ohio Wesleyan. And you need to go there and do the teacher. I think the teacher education is 2 years, yeah. So you need to go there and get a teaching degree. You'd make a good one. So he goes there. They don't have a football program. He does play baseball for him. But anyway, in 2 years, he's got his teaching credentials, and he comes back to West Virginia and teaches for 1 year. He says, "Mom, it's just not interesting enough. Not enough action for me." So he works for his dad in that supply shop for another year or two and says, "You know, this just is not interesting enough for me." And they're thinking, well, you know, there are always other things. And if you want to go into law and do some work here with the miners and right-of-ways and all the good things, he takes the bait on that. That was his introduction not only to law and to a career, but also to college football. They're all just beginning, a lot of schools, and all the schools they played were all just beginning to learn how to play football. And let's see, he was born in 1870, so this was about, 1895 and 6. And In the first year, they have a nice record, but they, you know, but it's, again, everybody's just playing beginners, bumping against beginners. The next year, they go 3-7-1, a pretty dismal record. He loved everything about it. The coach was well paid. They took him on to a preseason camp in Maryland. They got to play some really good schools, and he loved the whole experience. And they got to play. I'm trying to think now. School Lafayette. They played Lafayette 3 consecutive days in 3 different cities in West Virginia, and he got so. And Lafayette was an outstanding small college football team. They were going to take on Pennsylvania, which was had been for 3 years a perennial national champion, and the first game he played against Lafayette, he got smacked really good above the eye and split it open, the skin open, and so he comes out. He's not going to quit. He's made of iron, he thinks. The next day, he comes out again for the next game, second game, with a piece of beefsteak over the eye. And Park Davis, wonderful, wonderful coach, and a great man in the history of early football. He is genuinely impressed. And so then the doctor will not let the Yokes play the third game. And his dad had his grandpa was a doctor, so he got some pretty good advice. In any case, he doesn't play a third game. But he's won the heart of Park Davis, who says, you know what, you need to come transfer to our school and major in engineering. And we have a wonderful engineering school, and he would be a wonderful addition to our football team. And he does. He goes up there and plays, happens to be, the week of their game against Penn. Penn's coming in, I think, with a 32-game win streak. They've rolled over everybody, and Mark Davis's team, Lafayette, with Yost in the lineup at tackle, left tackle, beats them 6-4. Got a crowd of about 18,000. I mean, it's big time stuff. Well, that was a mountaintop experience for Yost, and that kindled a love for football that never died. So that's how he got interested in football.
Yeah, that's an extremely still a very volatile game to talk about, because the people down on the other side of the state, for me down in Philadelphia, they're still calling it the Yost affair, that game with him playing that one game for Lafayette, and they thought, you know, they claim bringing in as a ringer. And I know it's a long story, and you know, Yost years later said, you know, his intention was to go back to Lafayette, and it wasn't really just a one game thing that him and Park Davis thought up. Park Davis thought he was going to be attending there for a while, and Yost did too, but some other things got in the way of that. So,
well, it sounded scandalous, but the way in which Yost handled it added to the whole thing. This made matters worse. Honesty was not one of the strategies he used to explain his whereabouts. You know, I mean, it was clearly that this was the era of tramp athletes. In 1890, the University of Michigan's baseball team had, I think, I don't know the exact number, so I'll just make it up, but the point will be made. They played about 9 away games in baseball in the spring of the year, and I don't think in any of those games were a majority of the players University of Michigan students.
I mean, oh my goodness!
There was no control of athletics. It was the Big Ten in the 1896 that said there has to be some rules. First of all, we've let these guys run themselves, and as long as they didn't run up debt or get into any other trouble that would get the university in trouble, we'd find somebody on the faculty who liked the young men, and they would like him, and he'd keep them out of trouble and help them pay their debts. And they'd do, they'd have to play some games in cities where they could, pass the hat and make some money from donations. But it basically, they were just young men at play, primarily men at play, and just stay out of trouble. This is an academic environment, and that's where we star, say the faculty and the presidents. And but then what they did not realize was that there was a love of sport that was being kindled in the 1880s in the New England area, and then in the 1890s in the Midwest. And it took, people would gather, and if you could put a good team together, you would begin to generate some strong income. And then the faculty and the presidents really became involved. And then as Coach Yost, my story of Coach Yost points out, that's the title that's the chapter I entitled All Hell Breaks Loose. They went from playing 11 games a year to 5, only one of which could be a strong opponent, so there would be no champion. The faculty finally put a foot down and came back to haunt them.
Doctor, before we get into that, I just want to make sure, touch a little bit more of the background before we get into his coaching, because he did, I mean, something I found really interesting that I learned about Coach Yost from your book is that he, in the center of professional football right at its birth, within at least the first 5 years of its birth in the Pittsburgh area as well before he went into coaching.
Yes. Yeah, there's a group in the Latrobe area, the Pittsburgh area, of really good professional players, and they made no distinctions. As a matter of fact, sometimes when in the coaching that Yost did, he would get agreement from the opposition to let him play. Sometimes they were hiring coaches sometimes to both coach and play. So there were very few rules that would make for equity in competition or anything resembling the rules we have governing sports today. But anyway, he did get the chance to play with some of those all-star teams in the Pittsburgh area. So, and when he played, he really learned a lot. About the, first of all, you had to play both offense and defense. There's no just one way players. And against the best players, and he was a strong and a tough guy and a smart guy, he learned quickly and became a very outstanding athlete. And it wasn't so much that he learned that so that he could play professional ball, he could teach it, and he did, and it was one of the key features in his successful coaching career. His ability he would dress for practices and get down there, and I've got some good stories about when he was at Michigan. And he has them gathered at the start of the year, and he's giving them a little pep talk and a little here's organizational meeting, and he grabs a guy, and to demonstrate, but the guy is really caught by surprise, and so Yost starts demonstrating, and he's got this guy, he's a big guy, he's got him upended, and if he comes forward, Yost knows that's going to happen, and he's got him on his nose. If he goes back, he's got him on his heels. I mean, he was outstanding at, first of all the skills, demonstrating them, and loved to do that. And that fellow became an All-American at the University of Michigan Center, great, great athlete that Yost was toying with. And he said, I learned a lot. The biggest thing I think I learned was that the next year at that preliminary practice, I was going to be way, way back in the pack. Not going to volunteer me, to face Yost. Anyway, but yeah, so that he did have professional experience, but now, you know, this is not professional in the sense that we have today, professional football today.
But he's playing with the Allegheny Athletic Association, who played against Latrobe and the Pittsburgh, some of the other Pittsburgh clubs, you know, the John Brailliers, Pudge Heffelfingers, Bob Shirings, Blondie Wallace's, those type of guys were playing in that same era. And that's some tough, hard-nosed football. And like you said, it teaches some lessons about how to play single platoon football and stay on your feet and stay in a game without getting killed, you know. I think that's important, I think, in this lesson of some of his fundamentals that he taught, like you said. So he gets his playing days are somewhat over, and he starts to move into coaching. What happens next?
Well, he comes back from this great experience, having played with the Lafayette team and winning. Basically, they were named then the top team of the year. National champions Lafayette was, and Park Davis, the coach, made sure that Yost, even though he was on there for one game, got his L, the major letter. He was and he wore that L on a sweater, very, very often. So anyway, now he has been to the summit and has succeeded. Just 2 years of his graduate school training is over. He's got his law practice certification. And so now what he wants to do is to be a lawyer and help to learn some things about mining and how to get things, the minerals from the ground and into plants and into the work world. He also, when he goes to get that, the training for teaching at Ohio Wesleyan, he joins the Sigma Chi fraternity and becomes a lifetime member and a tremendous the fraternities were big, and those were opportunities to get influence centers. They came from all corners, and they knew people who knew people. So He Yost was so abundantly confident that it's very easy for people to say he is a braggart. He is a pain in the rear with his bragging. When he did something really well, he couldn't shut up about it. So he has to tell the boys at Ohio Wesleyan what he's done. And what this Lafayette thing was all about, and how great it was, and of course how great he was. And so they're saying at the fraternity house, you know, why don't you come here and coach us, coach our team? Well, it says, you got to set it up for me, and I'll see what I can do. So they set things up for him, and he saw what he could do. Out he goes. He has no intention of staying, and he's just going to go out and coach football that fall, and he's going to come back to West Virginia and do his lawyering. He gets out there, and my gosh, they learn very quickly, and he's showing them things that they would never have learned anywhere else. He is really prepared to be a good coach of technique. They get the third game on their schedule. Is one with the University of Michigan. Now, they're totally out of their league. And even though Michigan football in the 1890s was not all that great, it was certainly a long way ahead of Ohio Wesleyan. Anyway, he gets the agreement, because he's only got 11 guys. He's got 10 and himself. He gets the agreement from the captain is very often the responsible person who makes decisions at that point in time in the 1890s. And so he says to the captain, I'd like to play if you don't mind, so we can have 11. Yeah, okay, good, no problem. Now, it's all very informal, almost like intramurals. And of course, they're playing this podunk Ohio Wesleyan, so there's not a lot of sweat here anyway. Well, he plays, and he has his team so psyched up Michigan can't score on them. And the game ends in a 0-0 tie. This does not sit well with the sports reporter for the Michigan Daily, who he decries the whole event. He says that basically, you know, they said they were going to do everything they could to win, including biting and pulling hair and everything else, and they did exactly that. Well, he accused them of just being, you know, very dirty football players. And then, of course, he concludes his own article in the write-up on the game in the Michigan Daily by saying, and the referees stood around doing nothing. So, you know, any referee at that point in time was a, you know, you almost had to get somebody. Well, in some cases, the coach of one team would do the offensive side, and the coach of the other team would do the defensive side, and then they'd switch back. I mean, it's very informal. Anyway, Yost brings them to a wonderful season conclusion, and Ohio State is just learning football at this point in time. They beat Ohio State, too. And so they crown themselves as the champions of Ohio. So that's his first year of coaching, 1896. He happily goes back to West Virginia, but he cannot get football out of his head.
He's got the bug, right?
He's got the bug. And now he doesn't, I don't recall that he got much in the way of money for that. But it was salaries for the persons in the United States in the 1890s were somewhere around $350 to $400 a year. He gets a call from, and he finds that he gets his Sigma Chi guys going. They find that Nebraska needs a coach. He gets everybody who saw his team play to write for him. He knew how to mash the support.
And he had so, he had the network in place, and they were looking out for him.
Yeah, absolutely. And they wanted to. I mean, you couldn't say no to this guy. So now he goes to Nebraska. They say they're going to pay him $340, but I think he only got about half of that. But anyway, but he wasn't that interested in the money anyway. He said it's okay. And really, that's almost a third of the wages of a person who's doing full-time 12-month work. Anyway, my gosh, their big rival was Kansas. And they go through a wonderful season, and they beat Kansas. So they call themselves then the champions of the league, and they are. So now he's been at Nebraska. That's his second year of coaching, and I think they lose one game. He says, you know, this is fun, and you know the money isn't all that bad. Kansas says, you know, we would love to have you.
Before I let you leave Nebraska, you have a very interesting tidbit. Something else that I learned, that Nebraska was not called the Cornhuskers at that point in time before the 20th century. They had a different nickname, and I thought this was kind of interesting.
They were the Bug Eaters.
I couldn't let that one go, Doctor.
You talk about students being involved in their own game here. Hey, what do you think we should call ourselves? I got it. How about the Bug Eaters? Hey, let's do that.
Yeah, that's one ball game where I wouldn't want to visit the concession stand. Let's just say that.
Oh, good. So, of course, there's always a manager of football, someone who can put the schedule together and do the kind of things it took, to have you really only have about 25 guys on the team. So anyway, mm-hmm. so now Yost decides that he will take. Well, they don't have enough money at Nebraska to hire him back. They hardly could pay him what they promised in the first place, but Kansas did. And so he gets everybody who saw him play, including the manager, at Nebraska to write for him, and he gets the Kansas job.
Can you imagine that? Okay, so Kansas is their biggest rival at Nebraska.
Yes.
He talks to his players who probably don't want him to leave, and his managers and everybody else, to write letters to get him a job at their rival who they're going to have to play again.
That's exactly right. And he goes to Kansas, and he goes 10-0. Of course,
wow.
He beats Nebraska and Missouri, two big rivals. But anyway, it's one of those things where, you know, they joke sometimes about the great coaches of today. You know, they say he's good enough that he can take his players and beat you. And then he can take your players and beat you with them. Oh, and beat the team that he left. That's it. You know, the point is that it doesn't matter which side that the players are on, or they're really good. If he's on that side, they're going to win. Smart guy, just knew how to coach. He knew how to motivate, and he knew how to get the students and fans on the side, the players, to really help them in practices, well-attended practices, you know, cheering the guys on. And he knew how to put on a show for that, Phil. Running signal calls, running up and down the field, and you know, there was no huddle at this point in time. I think Stagg came up with a huddle, but there was not yet, not in the 1890s, not in the early 1900s even. But in any case, he put on a show.
We're going to break off our interview right here and end this episode of it, but we're going to continue our talk with Dr. John Behe on Fielding HEOs. It's really starting to get into the good stuff once we get into Michigan and some of the traditions that he did start with, you know, the great book by Dr. Behe, Fielding Coach Yost, Michigan's Tradition Maker. You can find that book at behe.com, which is behe.com. Find it in the show notes. It gives you links here to buy this very excellent work by the good doctor, his second time around writing about Fielding H. Yost, old Hurry Up Yost, the great coach of Michigan for so many years. And, you know, and he tells why he believes he may be one of the greatest coaches ever to coach in college football in the United States. So make sure you tune back in just a few days where we'll come up with part two of Dr. John Behe, author, biographer of Coach Yost, Michigan's Tradition Maker, and is a great book, great story. So till tomorrow, everybody, have a great gridiron day.
That's all the football history we have today, folks. Join us back tomorrow for more of your football history. We invite you to check out our website, pigskindispatch.com, not only to see the daily football history, but to experience positive football with our many articles on the good people of the game, as well as our own football comic strip, Cleat Marks Comics. Pigskindispatch.com is also on social media outlets, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and don't forget the Pigskin Dispatch YouTube channel to get all of your positive football news and history. Special thanks to the talents of Mike and Gene Monroe, as well as Jason Neff, for letting us use their music during our podcast.
This podcast is part of the Sports History Network, your headquarters for the yesteryear of your favorite sport. You can learn more at sportshistorynetwork.com.
Hey there, football fans. This is Ross, the host of the Pigskin Tales podcast. I just need a few moments of your time to talk about the host of the Pigskin Dispatch podcast, Darren Hayes. He's expanded the Pigpen to search out information on the history of all team sports. It's a quest to find out about the competitors, teams, and places chronicled throughout athletic history through the uniforms and gear the participants used and wore. And he is taking you, the listener, with him on this educational journey to preserve sports history on the Sports Jersey Dispatch, found here on the Sports History Network. His newest podcast, called Jersey Dispatch, is all based on the jerseys that all the greats used to wear. You can find Darren Hayes and the Pigskin Dispatch podcast, as well as Jersey Dispatch, on your favorite podcast provider multiple times each week. So remember that Darren Hayes, the host of the Pigskin Dispatch and Jersey Dispatch podcasts. It's found right here on the Sports History Network.